on? Pretty much for a pocket. You know, may not be offended if I take off my jacket so I don't expire from heat exhaustion or something like that. That's it. Okay. Call security on this. So I'm waiting because I was, you know, it's in as much as this is not Episcopalian, right? So it is prohibited to start on time. So we're going to wait. Oh, in Atlanta you start on time? Really? Interesting. Okay. But I do have to wait for someone from the admin to give me the go-ahead. So we'll just tie as well.
Yeah.
It's becoming quite risque here. This is like I'm not. I thought the South was very genteel and stuff. Okay. Okay. Where is what's her name? Community's chilled, so I think we'll be okay. Where's that woman? What's her name? Rivka?
Rivka Freundlich.
Rivka Freundlich, yeah. Okay. So, Rivka Freundlich around? Where is she?
Mrs. Freundlich is...
She's left, or?
No, she's right here by the
front. Oh, okay. I just wanted to ask her, hi. I just wanted to ask her when I should start.
Oh, she's like maybe 7:40. Or I don't know if she's coming.
Oh, okay, fine.
Because the first night you always say, okay, so you think I'm late, right. I don't run late. Next time, let's start on time. I said,
we wait.
Please, fine.
Hey, so I just wanted to get directions when I should start.
Yeah, I think, what are we up to now, 7:32?
I think 7:40, and we'll flow into it, and then by quarter till 10,
it's
till
Atlanta,
the
ramp up.
Oh, okay, so you're going to announce or something like that?
Yeah, that's okay.
That's fine. Okay, great. Excellent.
Well, you say next week we're going to be...
I'm sorry I rolled in so late, but I mean...
Really?
I'm Charlotte.
I'm here on time. What?
Thank you.
Charlotte, we were in. We went to the Discovery Museum, and fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic. And we, you know, drove around downtown a bit, and then we just came here from Charlotte. But there was a lot of traffic outside Charlotte. We stayed last night in Reedsville.
You must be starving. You must be so.
We actually had tons of food with us.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah, we even have a
kids, you better be packed.
I know.
Oh, we have
I had all these plans. I was going to be cooking at the Silverman, so when we got here, I had a big plan.
Oh, we're okay. No, seriously, we're fine.
Okay.
What time are the restaurants open until, like, pizza store or
fire? Not so late.
Not late.
Would you like me to place an order somewhere?
That's all right. No, my wife's probably...
The supermarket's open again, and we have a ton of pleasure stuff.
Oh, good. Okay.
No.
Good. Okay.
I would take 5 more minutes.
Okay, great. That's immobilized reserves?
Yes.
It's insane, really?
So
two soldiers were killed?
Two were captured and eight were killed.
There was a Hezbollah attack across the border, is that how?
That's my understanding. The U.S. says that Tehran and Syria were involved.
You guys, you know, You don't want to stay for the lecture. You can go outside. Okay. Okay. No, sorry. I already have one on me, so if you just want to put it on. Okay. I'm happy to, you know, you can put it there or something. Oh, whatever. People don't sit in the front row usually, and most people don't sit in the front row. I know, right, but I'm saying that on the whole, people tend not to sit in the front row. It's like there's some fear of being abused by the lecturer. Hi.
Hello, I'm Mary Nicole.
Oh, nice to meet you. Yes, yeah, how are you doing?
So actually, I remember when you were here at the
Shelaton. Yeah, Shelaton down in downtown.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I'm delighted that you're here.
Great to be here. We got into town at 6:45.
I have not done anything about you. You asked me graciously whether we should arrange for you to speak elsewhere the day that you come in, but I haven't done anything about that yet. But we'll
okay, we'll talk. Yeah, you have my cell phone number, and yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
I'll email.
Well, I have email. I have email, so you can just email me, or okay. I have cell phone. And in Gaza, I didn't hear anything. We were driving all day.
I haven't heard anything about Gaza.
Well, that's quite a shock. That's a...
They're
going to start kind of people over here in about 3 hours. Yeah. Yeah, we have plenty of stuff. It's not my way. I'm going to be standing over there. It's really fine. It's really fine. I'm more nervous about while I'm tangling it, it gets unplugged, and then I have to set the whole, reset the whole thing. So I prefer just. I just saw Mitsubishi has a new projector.
Okay.
Which is weighs 1 pound.
Wow.
And is palm size, and has a battery pack, so you don't have to plug it in.
Wow.
And someone else told me that Trio, the new Trio, you can run PowerPoint of it. So in future, I can see myself in future, just take the projector out, take the phone, put it over there. Is that blue? Yeah, I'm ready. Yeah.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see all of you here. We're thrilled to have everyone try back on here with us for the next week, teaching a myriad of classes. And I have required that people have misplaced their pamphlets at the hearing to camp and people. So if you have any, I'd register with the COLA, or if you wouldn't mind calling Marcia at your convenience. I'm sure you all have the number by now. We're thrilled to have the Bethel family here. Mrs. Bethel will also start teaching classes starting Sunday evening following her Bethel classes. She'll begin at 8:30. So that's how we do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm from Australia, as you may hear from the accent, which is, I believe, also south of the Mason-Dixon line, so that there's a certain affinity here. I'm sorry, I just like, we got into town at 6:45, drove in from Charlotte, actually Reidsville this morning, stopped in Charlotte, lots of traffic along the way. I just wonder, just as a point of interest, in South Carolina, are there any other industries aside from peaches and fire fireworks? Is there anything else there aside from, and abandoned cars? That seems to be also a common feature. I don't know, something strange. But anyway, so first of all, I just heard very disturbing news that Israel has, there was further soldiers, some soldiers were killed, two were kidnapped, captured, and Israel has mobilized reserves. I used to be in the reserves, but obviously not anymore. But so I'd like to at least dedicate the merits of our Torah study, first of all, to the return of the captives. I don't know the names of the two who were just captured today, but Gilad ben Aviva, in Gaza, his Refuah Shleima, healing of him, and of course to the merit of the protection and the success of our soldiers who are at the moment going into battle. And I think the least we can do is the merit of learning Torah, studying together, to think that should to help them and to dedicate it towards them. So what I'd like to do today is to discuss the idea of Jewish survival, and what does Jewish survival say about Judaism and about the Jews and about the Torah. My methodology is going to be the following. Methodology is going to be this. You know, let's say you observe, I read an article in Scientific American not long ago by an astronomer. He was at a barbecue in Scottsdale, Arizona. Now, certain professions, you always get asked questions about your profession, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter what hour of the day or night. I mean, I'm sure there are people who know this, right? If you're a physician, you'll probably get asked questions often, you know, at shul, stuff like that, whatever, you know. If you're a rabbi, I mean, I'm standing in people's paths, is this kosher? I say, look, I'm not working, I just eat it, right? So, but there are, you know, so this astronomer, he's at this barbecue, and it's Scottsdale, Arizona. It's a very beautiful, clear night. There's very little smog. And they're looking up at the stars, and of course, they know he's an astronomer. So someone's going to come over to him. Inevitably, he knows this. So he's, like, studiously looking down at his steak, right? And someone says, what's that star? And he looks up and he says, I have no idea. The guy says, what do you have no idea? You're an astronomer. How could you not know? He says, listen. He says, I haven't looked at the stars for about 20 years. I said, what? He says, yeah, I don't look at stars. I research planets around other stars. He says, you can't see them. There are no telescopes currently available until they produce the mega super telescope, but there's nothing available now that can actually see these planets. He says, I actually spend all my time in front of a computer screen looking at the electromagnetic radiation emitted by stars. So the guy says to him, well, yeah, but how do you see planets? They generally don't emit electromagnetic radiation unless there are creatures on them that have garbage like television, right? So he says, you're not going to see. So he says, look, this is very simple. He says, I can tell if a planet is orbiting another star by the effect that that planet's mass has on the radiation and the light coming from that star. Because, as we learned today in the Discovery Science Center in Charlotte, where I took the kids today, right, gravity is type of light, we know, is curvature of space-time. And which means an object of great mass, right, space-time will curve around it, so to speak. And which means that light and electromagnetic radiation, or I should say light and other electromagnetic radiation, will curve also. So the bigger, the greater the mass of the object and its position, you can tell by its effect on the light or on the radiation without having ever seen the planet. Is this clear, folks? Okay. Which means you can observe the planet based on the effects that the planet has on the light from the star. The same is true with particles. We can observe and know what's the nature of certain particles that cannot be directly observed because of their size, the smallest, right? However, we can know that they're there because of the impact they have on other particles. In the same way, I cannot directly observe God. I cannot directly observe God. In fact, my mind cannot even wrap itself around God. As a great Hebrew poet once said, Solomon ibn Zirol said, "Ilu yidativ hayitiv," which means, if I'd know him, I'd be him. Because the only way you can know him in a true sense is having an infinite mind. The only infinite mind that exists is God. So, however, what I can know is the impact of God on the world. So in the same way that I'm going to look at the forces of particles and know a lot about the particles from the forces, in the same way I can look at the radiation and light and know a lot about the planets by its impact on that, I can look at the effects of God in history, and I can know a lot about God from his effect in history. Is this clear so far? In addition, so the way I'm going to do that, we're going to compare the history of many different nations. I'm going to pretend, for example, that I'm an alien. I find that disturbingly easy to do, right? So I'm going to pretend, let's say, that I'm this alien from outer space. And, I mean, it's easy for me to have a green card. But in any case, think of myself as an alien from outer space. We've got a lifespan of, you know, whatever, 50,000 years. And we have an assignment in high school. It's about 10,000 years of high school, whatever. Right? And we have an assignment in high school to track the history of nations on Earth. So we've got to go down to Earth and observe it for, let's say, 5,000 to 6,000 years. You know, so we're going to start with Sumeria, ancient Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, blah, blah, yada, yada. Right? And we're going to go through to modern times. And as part of the project, we're going to try to identify certain trends in various nations. So here we are, the various aliens, and who, of course, their tentacles all over their body, made of silicon, eyes everywhere, that type of stuff, standard. Yeah. You know, of course, there's this guy sees an alien landing. Alien gets out of the UFO. This alien, he looks at him and he says, God, never seen anything like it in his life. And he says to the alien, he says, do all of the beings in your planet, are they all covered, are they all made of silicon? And the alien says, yeah, like totally. And he says, of course the alien speaks English, right? And he says, and do all the beings on your planet, do they all have tentacles everywhere? And he says, oh yeah, of course. He says, do all beings on your planet have eyes all over their body? And he says, yeah. He says, do all beings on your planet have that round black thing on your head? He says, oh, no, only the Jews. But okay. We're going to identify certain trends in history. And once you identify certain trends in the history of nations, you will see that a nation that doesn't conform to the standard historical trends indicates the existence of another force or forces at work. In the same way, as if there's one particle which seems to be acting totally differently, I would say, well, maybe there's another force that I'm familiar with, you know, in addition to the weak force, strong force, magnetic, right, etc. So maybe there's another force. Same thing we're going to say here. We're going to look at various trends in history. We're going to see, do the Jews, do the Jewish people, do the history of the Jews, is it standard? Right? Is Jewish history just standard, run-of-the-mill, right, you know, a la carte history, or is there something strange, unique, and bizarre about Jewish history? And when we can see what strange things there are in Jewish history, we can identify the characteristics of that force by its impact on the nation. So the first part of it is Jewish cultural survival. Right? And when I say cultural survival, I don't mean only physical survival. Because physically, I mean, everyone survived. I mean, basically, genes of gene centers survive. You know, I mean, I'm sure there are people in this room, and I just recently saw some genetic study that indicates that if you go back far enough, you've got the genes of just about everyone that existed somehow in you, right? But I'm sure we've got Etruscan genes in us, and I'm sure we've got Sumerian genes. Well, definitely got Sumerian, right? And so on and so forth, Levites. I mean, but in any case, we've got the genes tend to survive. Physical survival doesn't impress me, right? What I'm talking about is cultural survival. And like, for example, we could pick certain features like language would indicate strong cultural survival. Homeland and a common and consistent homeland throughout history. Things like cultural artifacts like mikveh, tefillin, mezuzah, Torah scrolls, so on and so forth. Religion. And I'd like to contrast that with others. Like here, for example, there are many physical survivors, Greeks. I just was reading in a local newspaper in New Jersey about a high school class from Fort Lee who went to visit Athens as part of a class trip for 2 weeks, 2 weeks in Athens. Now, I was thinking to myself, I wonder what course they're doing that would, you know, justify a trip to Greece. Okay, so what would you imagine? What are they studying that would enhance their studies by going to Greece? So I thought Greek history, Greek history, maybe Greek poetry or literature, geography, right? How about, no, they're not Jewish. They're not studying Russian. No. Philosophy. That's the last thing I would think of. You see, today, anyone name a famous Greek philosopher, present day? Just one, really, just one. One Greek philosopher? How about 200 years ago? Greek philosopher, famous. How about 500 years ago, Greek philosopher, anyone? 1,000 years ago? Famous Greek philosopher from 1,000 years ago. Do I hit 2,000? Famous Greek philosopher 2,000 years ago. No, so you see, to go to Greece today to study philosophy, you'd have to be out of your mind. Right? You go to Greece today, right? You're not going to study philosophy there. Geography, I can understand. Archaeology, definitely. Right? History, definitely. Right? But philosophy? The Greeks today have very little relationship to the ancient Greeks. Physically, they do. But what is the religion? Most Greeks are secular socialists, which means they are following the philosophy of a Jew called Karl Marx. Okay. The other Greeks are Greek Orthodox, which means they're following the philosophy of a Jew called Jesus. Okay. So either way, okay, the Greeks are not very much following Archimedes and Plato, etc. Right. The modern Greek, the language. David Ben-Gurion, first Prime Minister of the State of Israel, was a scholar. He was a very, I mean, as opposed to many, I mean, the State of Israel, with all its all the wondrous stuff which we're going to talk about, you know, further, but as you know, has been ruled for most of its history by WASPs. White Ashkenazi Socialist Paratroopers, right? And most of these WASPs were not great scholars. David Ben-Gurion was a great scholar, and he could he knew classical Greek. So apparently the story goes, first time he met the Greek Prime Minister, he told the translator, the interpreter, he says, I don't need an interpreter, I'll speak to him in Greek. So he starts with some statement in classical Greek. The Greek Prime Minister looks at the interpreter and he says to him, what's up to you? He says, what's he talking about? Right? They didn't understand each other. So because modern Greek and ancient Greek, no relationship. Rome. The Romans, there are Romans today, there are Italians today, it's Italy. I'm so happy with the World Cup. I cannot tell you how much joy I got from France losing. And France losing because they were obnoxious, right? Because the best player on the team headbutted someone, right, because he got upset at him, and then he got knocked off the field, and then Italy won. You know, I feel good. Italians are very much like Jews. I always feel an affinity to Italians. I don't know why. Okay, but in any case, maybe it's the food thing or something. Anyway, so... but the present-day Italians and Romans have very little relationship to the ancient Romans. Most of them are Catholic, which means, again, they're following a biblical religion. They're not, it's not Zeus anymore and stuff like that. Okay. Number two, in terms of their food, their culture, very little of it has any relationship to the ancient Romans. The language, they don't speak ancient Greek, they don't speak Greek, they don't speak Latin, right? They speak Italian. So, very, very little relationship. Mexicans, African-Americans, right? Very few of these people have any relationship to their ancient culture, not necessarily for fault of their own. I was on the plane from Seattle to Detroit once. I sat down, it was a fairly empty flight. It was actually a small plane. It's a commercial flight, but fairly small. Have you ever been on these planes? They're small enough that they actually ask for people to move to keep the balance. I mean, so they actually asked the two people to move to the back of the... That makes me very nervous. I thought, what if I have to go to the bathroom during the flight? I mean, it's like, oh my God, get that guy out of the bathroom! The plane's going over! Like, you know, whatever, I don't know. So, so two people moved to the back, myself and an African-American woman with a crucifix. I assume she is not Jewish. And she's sitting next to me. We're both at the back here. So the plane gets to cruising altitude, and I could not hear, my ears had not popped, so I couldn't hear her dancing. And they came around with the meals. They served kosher food first, that's in order to exacerbate anti-Semitism. And so I get the, I open the, with great difficulty, managed to actually open the kosher meal, which for some reason kosher organizations feel has to have Kevlar around it, which is a bulletproof. I managed to finally open it, and of course the customary spurt of gravy goes directly for my thigh, like homie goes, like smart gravy. So anyway, I finally get it open, and for those of you, by the way, who have difficulty believing, have faith issues, you know, when we are told it in the 10 plagues, hail, the hail, came down with fire, fire and ice together. For those who have difficulty with that, just open a kosher meal on a plane. It is unbelievable to me. Half of the food is about the temperature of the surface of the sun. You touch it with your finger or burn it down to a stump. And the other half looks like leftovers from the Shackleton expedition. It is frozen solid, permafrost. I mean, it's unbelievable. So, and in the same container, it's unbelievable. It's a miracle. I stood up and I said, I believe that! Anyway, so, but I digress. So I get the food, and I said the brach, I said the blessing over the food, which I said pretty loud because I couldn't hear. So I say, about that level. That's the blessing you make on food that you cannot identify, by the way. So I make this blessing, and this woman says, excuse me? And I said, I started chewing, I could now hear, and I said, oh, didn't say anything. She said, you said something pretty loudly. I said, oh, I'm sorry. I actually wasn't talking to you. She says, there's no one else around. I said, I was talking to God. And she said, what did you say? And I, you know, went through that. Turns out she's a pastor, actually, at some type of Baptist church. And we got into schmoozing about blessings and prayer and stuff like that. Very interesting talk. Anyway, in the course of the conversation, she said to me, she said, I'm very jealous of you. I said, usually people say that. I know, that's all right. But anyway, but no, I didn't say that. So I was quiet, just to let her explain herself. And she said, look, you said that blessing in Hebrew. I said, yeah. She said, that's the language of your ancestors. I said, yeah. She said, where do you live? At the time I was living in Israel. She said, you live in the land of your ancestors. She said, do you know your tribe? I said, yeah, I'm a Levite. She said, do you know your tribe? She said, the religion is the same religion as your ancestors. Saying the same blessing goes back, well, I said, at least 2,300 years, right, to the period of the writing of the Mishnah. So she said, my family, we've been out of Africa, exiled from Africa for approximately 250 years. I do not know my tribe. I do not know my language. I do not know my religion. I do not know the music. I don't know anything about my native culture. Not a clue. 300 years of exile, and I don't know anything about it. I'm disconnected. She says, I believe in Christianity, and she was very comfortable in Christianity, but she said, deep down, I'm disturbed by the fact that it may not be me. And I thought of that, and it's very true, isn't it? It's a tragedy. People disconnected from their roots. And the same is true all over the world, with the exception of the Jews. It's an amazing thing. And let me go through some of these features. Language. This is the scroll of Isaiah from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Probably a little hard to read for you here. But the scroll of Isaiah the Dead Sea Scrolls were written down approximately 2,000 years ago. And of course, Isaiah lived about 2,600 years ago. So here's a document dating back to 2,600 years. You go to any society today, give a child a document written 2,600 years ago and say, read this. Mexican child, read something written 2,600 years ago by the Aztecs or the Mayans. They wouldn't have been able to do that. That's not a possibility. Anyone read Chaucer? Chaucer? In high school, it's what we call child abuse. Right? But I read Chaucer. Chaucer, how old is Chaucer? It's like 500 years? It is almost incomprehensible. You take someone from England and get a kid from England to read something written 3,000 years ago in England. Of course, they weren't writing in England 2,600 years ago. They were running around naked, painted blue, killing each other. It's probably like Manchester United games today. But the fact is, my children, we were at the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit at the Israel Museum. One of my sons, who's now, how old is he? 17, right. So he climbed up on that. He was at the time, I think, 11. And he starts reading it. Chazon Yeshua ben Amos. And he says, Abba, come over here. I come over. He says, we were doing this in school 2 weeks ago. And I said, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. He remembers what he's doing in school 2 weeks ago. It was unbelievable. I was crying like a baby at the museum. But even more than that, here is a child of the 21st century reading something written 2,600 years ago. He can read the language. He could probably communicate with Isaiah if he walked into the room. He could probably communicate with Yirmiyahu if he walked into the room. Because when Yirmiyahu talks about honoring the Sabbath and calling it a delight and not doing commerce. My son knows what that means. And when Isaiah talks about honoring it and calling it a delight, he knows what that means. They're talking about the same Shabbat. When they talk about tefillin, when they talk about the Torah, it's the same thing, the language. Even though modern Hebrew is considerably evolved and changed, but the fact of the matter is, someone who speaks modern Hebrew could read a Tanakh, could read prophets, and understand it very well. Very little cultural gap in terms of language. Artifacts. We mentioned artifacts. You know, the tefillin that I put on this morning in Reidsville, right? There's no shul in Reidsville. It was the comfort in young Israel. But the tefillin are the same tefillin that my ancestors wore. I know that because we have tefillin from 1,900 years ago, which have got the same parchment that we have, and they're black and they're leather boxes. The mikveh that you have here is almost exactly the same design as the mikveh in Masada. That goes back to 150 BCE. That's more than 2,000 years old. The mezuzahs that you have on your doors are the same mezuzahs our ancestors had going back 2,100 years. So if someone asks me, how do you know your Judaism is the same as 2,000 years ago? I say, well, I know in quite a few areas. I know that our Tanakh, our Torah, prophets, and writings are the same. I know that our language is the same. I know that our Shabbat is supposed to be a delight and is honored, etc. I know that the tefillin is the same, the mikveh is the same. I mean, what else? I mean, you want the recipe for gefilte fish that Jeremiah had, Jonah? I don't know. Whatever. So, and all of this in and of itself would be a phenomenon that is shocking enough as it is and unusual enough as it is. But the fact is it was also predicted. The Torah tells us in Deuteronomy 31, it shall be when great and severe troubles overtake him, this song shall be a testimony to him because it will not be forgotten from the mouths of his descendants. The Jewish people, the Torah tells us, will not forget the Torah. We'll always have Jews who know the Torah. The Torah won't be forgotten. 3,216 years ago, God wrote in Deuteronomy, he said, don't worry. You won't. The Torah will not be forgotten. You know, a lot of community organizations, a lot of the Federation stuff, they're all concerned about Jewish continuity. You'd have to live in a cave not to have heard about Jewish continuity, right? I, frankly, am not concerned with Jewish continuity. I'm concerned with individual Jews. Judaism and the Torah will continue. The only question is, will the individual Jew that I'm talking to be part of that continuity or not? There's no guarantee that Jews will all survive, because Jews have disappeared by the millions due to assimilation and ignorance and persecution throughout history. So Judaism and Jewish continuity is guaranteed. There's no guarantee on any individual. That's what I'm concerned about, is the individual, not so much Jewish continuity. Now, this survival that we're talking about, which is pretty amazing, it would be amazing enough in and of itself. It would be amazing enough that it was predicted. What makes it even more interesting is that it's against all odds. And despite, first of all, a duration of exile, which is 2,000 years from the Second Temple's destruction, 2,500 years from the First Temple's destruction. Anyone here of Iraqi Jewish descent? Baghdad. There is a large community of Iraqi Jews. Most of them do not live in Iraq anymore for obvious reasons. Most of them live in Israel, right? And do you know how long? Iranian Jews. I think that here there's a large community of Iranian Jews. The Iranian Jews and the Iraqi Jews, do you know how long they've been in exile? How long they've been, when they were first thrown out of Israel, exile was when the Babylonians, which was ancient Iraq, destroyed the first temple. That's approximately 2,500 years ago. Tomorrow morning is the beginning of a fast day that commemorates, amongst other things, the 17th of Tammuz, the breaching of the walls of Jerusalem. So that destruction means, so here are Jews who were exiled from Israel 2,500 years ago. They didn't have their own country. They didn't have their own autonomy. They did not have their independence, government, nothing. And they were persecuted 2,500 years. And those Jews, do they still identify as Jews? 100%. Very strongly so. President of Israel is an Iranian Jew. Isn't that amazing? When I look at that, I say to myself, here we are. 2,000, this man's ancestors were exiled from Israel when the Babylonians destroyed the first temple 2,500 years ago. Think of the path that his family has gone through, and he's now president of a Jewish state in Israel. It's pretty wild, isn't it? to me, that's just like, that's incredible. But in any case, that's a long exile. Most people have not been in exile for that long. That woman I was talking to on the plane, she was in exile for 300 years. And all her culture was gone. All of it. Not a shred remained for her. Then there's also anti-Semitism, which is intense, universal, and irrational. I mean, we know that it's from all over the place. I mean, look at an organization like the International Red Cross. Right? The International Red Cross, can you imagine this? 55 years, 60 years, they've not accepted the Magen David Adom, right? The Magen David, the red Magen David, as a symbol. No. The Red Crescent? Yes. The cross? Yes. They finally compromised that allow Israel, and it's nice of them, we could use a diamond, like a, you know, what, a diamond shape or something like that. I mean, is that not anti-Semitism? A cross is okay, and a crescent is okay, but not a Magen David. Right, Woody Allen, his parents, he says, used to send him to interfaith camp every summer. Interfaith camp. He says there, he was beaten equally by people of all races and creeds. So yes, there has been a certain universality to anti-Semitism. There's been an irrationality to it. And it is that they've been trying for thousands of years to get rid of us. They've been trying in many different ways. They've tried physically to destroy us, whether it was the Khmelnytsky pogroms, whether it was the Crusades, whether it was the Second World War, the Nazis, whether it was the communists. They've tried to destroy us ideologically through forced conversions, through inquisitions, etc. Today, there are people at the Southern Baptist Convention who would like to destroy the Jewish people by having us all become Christian. There's no difference, just the methodology. But they don't want there to be a people on the world called the Jewish people. They don't want us on the planet, right? So whatever reason these people have, some are motivated by religion, some motivated by, I don't know why, but there is definitely an intensity and universality of anti-Semitism, and nevertheless, we are still here. In addition, there's been assimilation. Positive and negative pressures to assimilate. Heinrich Heine, who, by the way, is this in focus, by the way? Because I'm not in focus, so I can't. Okay. So in any case, Heinrich Heine, who, as you probably know, was born Jewish and was baptized, he writes, the reason he got baptized, he says, I don't believe in Judaism, he says, I don't believe in Christianity. He says, I'm not even sure I believe in God. So why did I get baptized? He said, he called it the ticket of entry to European culture. Pragmatic. And there are a lot of Jews that, in Berlin, at the time of Moses Mendelssohn, do you know what percentage of the Jewish population of Berlin had become baptized? Time of Moses Mendelssohn, the great philosopher. Anyone have any idea? Want to give a guess? What percentage of Jews in Berlin had become baptized at the time of Moses Mendelssohn? It was 40 to 50%. 40 to 50%. So Heinrich Heine was not a loner in that. Right? It was not an uncommon thing to do. So we've had a lot of pressure. Because why? To get into university, you have to be Christian. Right? To get into the various salons, you have to be Christian. There are many places where they based your civil rights on your abandonment of Judaism. Napoleon once said, to the Jews as Jews, nothing. To the Jews as Frenchmen, everything. So yeah, of course you can have liberty, eternity, and equality, but with one condition. Just get rid of your identity. No. Get rid of your identity and everything's cool. So there's been a lot of pressures, both positive and negative. No isolation. See, that's an important point, because people often mention to me, well, the Chinese and the Indians have been around for a long time, and their culture seems to be also quite intact. Is that right? But you see, there's a very important point to mention here, which is, when you are talking about survival, there are certain things which are advantages. One of them is isolation, both geographical and racial. For example, the Chinese and the Indians, where have they lived for most of the thousands of years of their history? In China and in India. And, by the way, their countries are quite isolated for a long time. And, in addition, right, they're racially different from those around them, which is helpful if you want to survive and not assimilate. The Jews have not had the benefit of isolation. In other words, we've been everywhere. We've lived all over the world and continue to do so. Right? So we haven't been isolated geographically. Racially, we're not isolated either. We tend to look like the people amongst whom we live. Very often, Jewish communities are pretty much, you know, Jews don't look radically different from the other people around them. So we haven't had those benefits, contrasted with the Chinese and the Indians, who, yes, they've lasted a long time culturally, but they've had geographic stability, they've had isolation, and they have a different appearance from their neighbours. Now, all this would be pretty amazing in and of itself, but it was also predicted. The Torah tells us in Numbers, indeed they are a nation that dwells alone, and they are not counted amongst the nations. You will call forth amazement, by the way, being not counted amongst the nations. Interesting. You know, the United Nations, one of the only country who is not able to sit on the Security Council is Israel. Because we're not members of any regional council. Where does Israel see? The Middle Eastern countries will not accept us as one of the Middle Eastern countries. So that means Israel is not in the Middle East. We're not in Europe either, right? And we're certainly not in the Pacific, so we don't really... Where is Israel? It's like, who knows, right? Who knows? So it's an amazing thing. The new United Nations Human Rights Commission, they just started recently, one of the first resolutions they made was they were, every meeting has to have a review of Israel, human rights abuses in Israel. Forget Iran, forget Sudan and Darfur, forget China and Tibet, forget Chechnya, forget Indonesia, right, Malaysia, I mean, most of the members of the United Nations, Israel. And guess who's not in the United Nations Human Rights Commission? Israel. Guess who is? One of the members is Iran. One of the members used to be Libya. Libya was actually in charge of it for a while. Interesting. But we're a nation that dwells alone. You will call forth amazement, reproach, and scorn amongst the nations to which God leads you. And yet for all that, says Leviticus, when they're in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, nor will I abhor them, nor to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them. God says, despite all this, I'll still be with you. And we're still around. So we have some interesting phenomenon here. We don't seem to fit in to what happens to other nations. We have very, very unique characteristics in terms of survival. And to make it all the more amazing, all of this was predicted. And to make it all the more amazing, it was in the face of intense opposition, which was predicted as well. There's also certain uniqueness about the Jewish people. First of all, we have many unique features. A, national revelation. The only nation that claims that God spoke not to an individual but to an entire people are the Jewish people. Most religions, what's the form of the revelation? God whispers something to one person, and that one person, Joseph Smith, goes into a cave in New York State somewhere, and he claims that the angel Moroni gave him some golden tablets. And he has signed testimony from two other people, I think it was three people. The tablets have disappeared, the people disappeared, and there are millions who believe in him. And there's no reason they shouldn't. Because even if it didn't happen, if it did happen, there's no evidence that you'd expect. And if it didn't happen, there's no evidence you'd expect, because it all happened in private. It is easy to lie about something like that. You know, people talk about seeing UFOs. Usually, it's two guys sitting in their backyard in Iowa somewhere, just after their third six-pack of beer, right? And they're sitting there like, oh, well, we saw this big round thing, and it was coming down, and it was like aliens. And, you know, and some reason these aliens are so advanced, they've got these flying saucers that can cover millions of light years, unbelievably advanced, and they choose as specimens to abduct these drunken, overweight, ignorant idiots, right? These are the specimens. They go, you know, why don't they want to abduct, they should get an Olympic athlete to study his body, right? They should get a Harvard scientist, right, to study his brain. Who do they get? These guys who are, I mean, the worst specimens of humanity you can imagine. Okay, whatever. So, but you see, in addition to which, always, when they see them, it's always in private. It would be far more impressive to me if at the graduation ceremony of the Princeton School of Aeronautical Engineering, in the presence of representatives of Rockwell, of Boeing, of many, many aerospace companies, with all these professors of aeronautical engineering and the graduating class, they all would have seen a UFO. I would say, that's impressive. That is impressive. It's in public. They have expertise, right? There are people who not, right? But you see, with revelation stories, always in private. No one saw the supposed resurrection. No one was up on the mountain with Muhammad, right? But God spoke to the entire Jewish people. That's an amazing claim. Public miracles, part of the same idea. Monotheism, very unique. Very unique. The whole concept of monotheism was very unique throughout the world and still is today. There are some basic mistakes, that people have made about that, but there are distortions of it, etc. But the idea of monotheism, in the ancient world, the most common belief was multiple gods, at least two, God of good and God of evil. But the idea that opposites can come from the one source, the idea that God is the source of everything, good and the opposite, light and darkness, so on and so forth, that's a uniquely Jewish idea. It's a very beautiful idea, and it's an idea which is what we call monotheism. Ethical imperatives. You compare Judaism to other ancient systems, and there's a lot of comparisons which archaeologists make between Judaism and, let's say, the Code of Hammurabi, which is an ancient Sumerian code. But there's a fascinating difference which is pointed out by a scholar called Leah Bronner. Leah Bronner points out, a very brilliant book called Biblical Personalities and Archaeology. She points out that in the Code of Hammurabi is all consequences. There's never any ethical imperative. Never do you find in the Code of Hammurabi something like thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. Rather, what it will say is, if you kill someone, this happens to you. If you steal, this is what will happen to you. Right? Never do you see something where it says love your neighbor as yourself. Don't take revenge, don't bear a grudge, you should rebuke your friend, and so on and so forth. It's always, if you do this, this will happen. Big difference. Ethical imperatives, very, very major difference. Judaism has an obligation to have children. That was a radical commandment. Today it's becoming radical again. But even in the olden days, it used to be quite radical, because if you read the ancient Sumerian stories and flood stories, etc., most ancient cultures believed that the gods were type of like these superhumans who were very, very threatened by too many people around. Downstairs neighbors making too much noise, right, or whatever, but they were threatened by too many people. God is not threatened by too many people, because God's on a different plane of existence. On the contrary, he wants us to procreate, he wants us to conquer the world, he wants us to be masters of the world. He gives us tremendous power because God is not threatened by us. The protection of the widow, the orphan, and the poor, very unique. In the Code of Hammurabi, you know who is protected? The landowners and the nobility. In Judaism, who's protected? The widow, the orphan, and the poor. Obligation to study, another radical feature. Jews have an obligation to study. What you're doing now is Torah study. That's a very unique thing. Most religions, the average layperson has no obligation to study. And the idea that the average layperson should study continuously, it's a very rare and very Jewish thing. And the size of the Jewish people always been small. An amazing, unfortunately or fortunately, but we've always been small. I mean, look at population figures of the Jews, for example. First of all, just to give you an idea of the extent of our exile, here are countries where Jews exist. I don't know if you can read them all, but there's Jews literally everywhere. There's Jews in Kyrgyzstan. Right, New Zealand. My niece went to Benaiah Kiva camp in New Zealand from Australia last summer. New Zealand, Kenya, there's Jews there's Jews literally everywhere. Here are countries which have less than 100 Jews in their population. So when you talk about the extent of our exile, there's very few people who are scattered to the extent that the Jews are scattered around the world. And this was predicted as well. We are told, right, God says you're a holy nation unto the Lord your God, and you are his treasure. Not because of your numbers did God choose you. Because of God's love for you, you're the smallest of nations. God, on the contrary, if there'd be a lot of Jews, it would worry me. Because I would say, well, the Torah says small in number. God will spread you out amongst the nations, and you'll remain small in number among the nations to whom he has brought you. During our exile, we'll always be a minority, always be small in number, and indeed, that is what has happened. And despite all of the above, you'd think, okay, so the Jews have survived, the Jews are unique, all this has been predicted, we're scattered all over the world, but you might say, yeah, but all this would be very insignificant if the Jews were a bunch of lowlives, if our culture was pathetic, right? If we made no contribution to the world or to humanity, then I would say, big deal. But on the other hand, first of all, Jews have always, compared to surrounding cultures, been, very, very advanced in terms of our education and universal literacy. It has been a common feature of the Jewish people to have literacy and education. Marriage, divorce and family life have always been on a very good level. No doubt these things are changing as we assimilate more, but throughout history our marriages the rate of divorce, family life has really been the envy of many peoples around us. Low crime and low violence rate, low rate of alcoholism and substance abuse, and tremendous philanthropy. In fact, a recent study in Johns Hopkins found that of the communities in the United States that give the most money to charity, both Jewish and non-Jewish, Jewish communities. New Orleans is a case, an example, where there's been a tremendous outpouring from Jewish groups to people who are survivors of the hurricane, etc. And community, tremendous sense of community amongst the Jewish people. Here is, by the way, this is from the British Journal of Addiction. And it's an article, one of actually many articles which I found, and the title of the article is The Great Jewish Drink Mystery. Here is a psychologist who's writing, actually a sociologist, who's writing in a journal of addiction about why is it that Jews have had such a low level of alcoholism. It's an amazing thing. I mean, the exception. I'm an exception. I mean, whatever. But I always look at it as divine providence. Our marriage, unbelievable divine providence. You know what I mean? My wife doesn't drink at all. So this is perfect. I married my designated driver. I mean, what more could you want? So, but anyway, so he offers many reasons for this. But you know, there's another sociologist I read, Marshall Sklar, who comments on this, and he writes how in studies of university students in the Boston area, and there are thousands of Jewish university students there, they found that those Jews who tended to be more observant religiously had the lower alcoholism rate as compared to the more secular students, which you might look at and say, well, duh, right? But I mean, that's sociology for you. But in any case, one of the comments he made was, it almost seems, he said, as though the more you make kiddush over wine, the less you might abuse it, which is part of an interesting perspective. Now, the impact. What about the impact of the Jews on the world? Well, in terms of law and morality, you just have to look at, for example, the writings of Selden, the English lawmaker, and Grotius from Holland, and the impact Judaism has had on the democracies of the world, the ideals of the prophets as part of democracy. I mean, think of it, right? Peace as an ideal. Where does that come from? Is it Teutonic? It's not, that's right, it's not from German culture, is it, right? The idea of peace being a value, right, is not from Greek culture, it's not from German culture, it's from Jewish culture. On the walls of the United Nations Plaza, what is written there is, not the graffiti, but the actual engraving, is written a verse from Isaiah, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, nations shall not raise sword against nation, they shall not teach war anymore. That ideal is from the Jewish prophets. The idea of self-determination, the idea, these are part of Judaism. It's interesting. The very first, Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of England points this out. The first moment, which would be the defining moment for the Jewish people, was the revelation on Mount Sinai. He says, what's interesting to note is, before God gave us the Torah, what did he do? He told Moses, ask the Jews if they want to accept this. Ask the Jews if they want to accept it. And the Jews said, yes, we want to accept it. He says, almost like there was a concept of self-determination built into our very beginning. Our self-determination was, we want to be the bearers of the torch of God and carry the Torah throughout history. That's the beautiful thing. But it's right there, law and morality. Monotheism and science, I mean, amongst others, North Whitehead has pointed out, actually, that monotheism has been at the basis of much of science. Why? The idea that the world makes sense, the idea that it's logical, the idea that I should be able to look for patterns and make sense of things, that it should be comprehensible, has its source, and Albert Einstein pointed this out in an essay, that idea has its source in monotheistic world outlook. Because the idea that the world should make sense, Einstein wrote, he says, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is the fact that it's comprehensible. Because if you approach it as being a result of random processes, why would you expect to be able to understand it? If you are studying science and investigating, that's with an expectation that you'll understand it. That expectation comes from, deep down, the idea that there is a God. Language. How much of an impact has Hebrew and the Bible had on languages? Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. So many of our phrases. Escaping by the skin of your teeth, you know where that comes from? Job. Drop in the ocean? Isaiah. Two is better than one? Proverbs. I mean, just go down the line, just about every major phrase in the English language, right? Unbelievable amount of words, whether it's camel, which is direct transliteration of gamal, whether it's something as esoteric as cannabis, which is from knebosem, which is fragrant spices, one of the ingredients of the anointing oil, right, and so on and so forth, right, coming from the Hebrew language in incredible ways. Whether it's philosophy, so much, virtually every topic in philosophy is somehow covered in the Torah, prophets, and writings, right, politics and art and literature, our impact has been overwhelming. Like, just here's an example. Like, you look at Jewish Nobel Prize winners and compared to our percentage in the population, right? For example, Jews and persons of half-Jewish ancestry have been awarded 159 Nobel Prizes, which accounts for 22% of all prizes between 1901 and 2002. Now, 22%, when the world's population, we are 0.25% of the world's population. It's embarrassing. It is embarrassing. You know, 2% of the U.S. population, and we've got 36% of U.S. Nobel Prize winners are Jews. This is mind-blowing. You know how many Muslims are there in the world? Anyone know? 1.2 billion. How many Nobel Prizes? Anyone have any idea? Seven. And one of them was Yasser Arafat for the Peace Prize. Okay. And this was predicted. The Torah tells us, I will give your descendants this land, and your descendants shall be a blessing to all nations of the world. And indeed, all nations in which we have lived, we have been a blessing to them. What we have contributed in arts and science and literature and economics and every way has been absolutely incredible. Senator Brownback from, I forgot which state, from Senator Brownback, Sam Brownback, anyone familiar, heard the name? He's one of the major supporters of Israel in the United States government. I mean, really major. And I mean, he comes from a state where there's like three Jews, I don't know, Iowa or something like that. So he's an amazing, and he told me that the reason he supports Israel is, he said, selfish reasons. I said, what's your selfish reasons? He says, I'm a religious Christian, he said, and I believe in the Bible. And the Bible says, I will bless those who bless you. God said to Abraham, I will bless those. I will bless those who bless you. He says, I believe that we are blessed if we bless the Jews. He says, so what Rabbi, he says, it's enlightened self-interest. That's an amazing thing. But the Torah says we'll be a blessing, and we have been. The land of Israel and the state of Israel. Now here, for us, oh my gosh, what's that? Okay, sorry. But for those of us who have been to Israel, or those of us who are familiar with Israel, we have to recognize in amazing ways the land of Israel and the state of Israel are things that show us divine intervention amongst the Jewish people in incredible ways. First of all, just think of it. For most of the history of the land of Israel, when the Jews were not there, Israel was a desolate, barren wasteland. Anyone ever seen a satellite map of the Middle East? It's fantastic. You've got to see a satellite map of the Middle East. You know what you see there? You can see a green area in the Middle East, approximately the shape of the state of Israel, and all around it is brown. All around it is brown. You know what? Because the only country which is flowering agriculturally in that area is Israel. You know what? In the only country in the entire world to enter the 21st century with a net increase in the amount of trees was Israel. Only country in the world to enter the 21st century with a net increase in the amount of trees was Israel. And, I should point out, that there's only one forest in the entire state of Israel that was not planted in the past 150 years. Because Israel has no forest to go. In America, there are forests that go back thousands of years. You go to the Redwood Forest and the Sequoia Forest, etc. They go back 5,000, 6,000 years. Israel, there's one forest in the Galilee that goes back about 2,000 years. All the rest of Israel was deforested by war over thousands of years. But unbelievable. But you go to Israel today, are there forests? Is there agriculture? I mean, think about it. It's amazing. The return of the Jews to Israel. The fact that millions of Jews, and by the way, this past year, the largest Jewish community in the world is now in Israel. Is now in Israel. The state of Israel has the largest Jewish community. That's a phenomenon which should make us like, wow, that hasn't happened in approximately 2,000 years since the destruction of the Second Temple. And they predict that maybe in 10 years, most Jews will be in Israel. Most Jews will be in Israel. The minority will be outside of Israel. It's an incredible thing. But if you would have told someone 150 years ago, you know, go to Madame Zelda, and you know, Christmas, she says, I see, you know, that there will be, I mean, you'd say she's crazy. I know this guy in Israel. I'm sure you've heard of him. Effi Eitam. Anyone met Effi Eitam? Effi Eitam, Ephraim Eitam, used to be Minister of Infrastructure in Ariel Sharon's government. Ephraim Eitam grew up on the shores of the Kinneret in a socialist atheist kibbutz called Degania. Okay. He was a commando in the Israeli army. He parachuted behind enemy lines many times in Lebanon. He is an extremely tough fellow. He eventually became a general in the army. Now, while he was fighting, he started to wonder, why am I fighting? Fighting for democracy? I can go to America and get democracy without fighting. He says, I'm fighting for McDonald's. I can get it better in America, and they have cheese too. Right? He said, why am I doing this? He started reading the Torah, which he'd gotten when you graduate from basic training in the Israeli army. Right? At the ceremony, they give you a gun, and they give you a Tanakh, Torah, prophets, and writings. He started reading it, and he got interested. And he went to yeshiva, and he got rabbinical ordination. Right? And then he went to University of Haifa and got a degree in politics and mathematics. And then he joined the government. Now, Ephraim Eitan said to me the following. He says, I remember we're sitting in his office, Minister of Infrastructure of the State of Israel. Mezuzah is on the door. He's got a big yarmulke on, right? And he's sitting there, he says, you know, he says, if anyone would have told my grandparents in Lithuania 70 years ago, you know, Madame Zelda would have said to them, you will have a child who is a rabbi. They would have said, you're out of your mind. Because they were socialists. Socialism and secularism was on the rise. That was it. Judaism was on the way out. They said, no way. And then Madame Zelda says, and in addition, you'll have a grandson who is going to be a commando in special forces in the Jewish army. They would have said, what Jewish army? Where? In Warsaw? What are you, crazy? No such thing. And then Madame Zelda would say, and you'll also have a grandson who'll be a minister of infrastructure in a Jewish state in the land of Israel. Then she would have said, I want my money back. Yeah, I want the $9.99 per minute. I want it back now. Right? And they would have said, and you'll also have a grandson who'll have a degree from a Hebrew-speaking university in Haifa in politics and mathematics. Right? It was actually Technion, one of the best technical institutes in the world. I don't know about Georgia Tech, but it's... Right. So, and then Matt, you know, he said, my grandparents would have been on the floor laughing. They would have been rolling around. He said, and then you would have told them, oh, by the way, they'll all be the same person. The rabbi, the commando, the politician, the mathematician, right, the minister, they'll all be the same grandson. Then they would have said, you are out of your mind. So I look at someone like Effi Eitam, and I'm seeing a miracle in front of my eyes. The return of the revival and survival, the military victories. I mean, these are miraculous. The refugees. What happened to the Jews? You know how many Jewish refugees there were in 1948 when the State of Israel was established? Anyone have any idea?
Over a million.
Well, there were approximately 600,000. So those 600,000 Jews were refugees from the Arab countries. Most of them went to the State of Israel. Between 1948 and 1951, the State of Israel, the population of Israel in 1948 was 600,000. Okay? They absorbed another 600,000 people within a space of 3 years. Do you know what that means? In the United States, there's how many million? 280 million? Okay? Can you imagine the United States absorbing 280 million refugees in 3 years? The United States would collapse. No, it would absolutely collapse. Right, here's a country, 600,000 people, absorbed 600,000 people. One of those refugees, again, as I said, is President Katsav. Another one of those refugees is a little boy who survived the concentration camps, who became chief rabbi of Israel, right, Rabbi Lau. Okay, so here are our refugees. They're not in camps. Right, they're not in terror cells. Right, they're productive members of society. The economics, the technology, and the agriculture. You know, cell phone technology was developed at the Motorola plant in Israel. Voicemail technology was developed at the Motorola plant in Israel. Of all the various countries that got satellites, countries with huge populations like China and the United States, Israel's got 2 satellites. Right? Israel has more high-tech startups per capita than any place in the world aside from Silicon Valley, California. It has the most biotech startup companies in the world. It has more engineers per capita. Do you know where the highest concentration of chess grandmasters is in the world? Any idea which city? Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is a small country, it's a small city in the Negev Desert, right? So you know what, a lot of Russian immigrants in Be'er Sheva, right? We have the highest concentration of grandmasters of chess in the world is in Be'er Sheva, right? So you're walking along in a park in Be'er Sheva and some old Russian guy says, hey, you want a game of chess? He's going to kill you. I'm telling you, he's going to destroy you, right? But that, the World Chess Olympiad was held in Be'er Sheva, right? Israel exports tulip bulbs to Holland. The tulip bulbs are growing in hothouses in the Negev Desert. Right, Israel has award-winning wine in the Golan Heights, which requires a cooler climate, and apples up there. You drive 2 hours south from the Golan Heights, Israel's growing pineapples and bananas and mangoes and guava and papaya, tropical fruits. You drive another 2 hours south, Israel's growing wheat, and Israel is growing flowers. Right, you drive towards the coast, Israel's got orange groves and olive groves, and exports citrus fruit all throughout Europe. So it's pretty wild when you think about the fact that Israel, for the past 60 years, has had large amounts of people, over a billion, trying to destroy it utterly from the face of the planet. And has spent much of that time trying to fight for its survival. You'd expect that a country could not do all this in 60 years. Right? But all this was predicted. The Torah says, so devastated will I leave the land, your very enemies who come to dwell in it will stand aghast at its sight. I'll turn Jerusalem into a heap of ruins, a haunt of jackals. I'll make the cities of Judah into desolation without inhabitants. That's what happened for thousands of years. But then the Torah says, but then the Lord your God will return your captivity. This, by the way, is the 5,708th verse in the Torah. You'll say, well, big deal. Well, 5708 is the Hebrew year that corresponds to 1948. It says, the Lord your God shall return you from your captivity and have compassion upon you. And he shall return and gather you from amongst the nations to which the Lord your God has scattered you, and the Lord your God shall bring you into the land of your fathers inherited. There is no greater indication of the redemption than this. And you, O mountains of Israel, you will bear your fruits for my people Israel. Rashi says, when the land of Israel gives its fruits in abundance, the redemption is approaching. An amazing thing. A famous essay in Mark Twain, he asks, how could it be? What's the answer to this? Mark Twain's answer is, Jews got money. Right? But that's not an answer which makes sense because Jews didn't always have money. And Jews don't all have money. You know, there are a lot of times throughout history, whether it was Poland or in the Pale of Settlement in Russia, in Lithuania, Jews were poverty-stricken. Poverty-stricken. Not money. Right? What is it? I think the answer to his question is very much that God is with us, and there's a guarantee and there's a promise. And my conclusions are that the Jewish people and our survival are basically unique amongst the nations. And the details of that survival are predicted in the Torah. If I put those together, what that tells me is that the survival of the Jews indicates a force who has guided and protected them for over 3,000 years. And that tells me that the Torah, which predicts these things, which has guided us throughout 3,000 years, has to be written by God, and something which we have to take very seriously. And so the way I look at it, the best evidence for the Jewish people's chosenness, the best evidence for the Torah, is really if we look into ourselves, into our own history, into our own families, into our own land, into our own culture, etc., throughout history. It's an amazing thing. Let me end with one story. I was in Israel a couple of years ago, and I ran into, I spent Shabbat with Rabbi Yisrael David Grossman. Rabbi Yisrael David Grossman spent Shabbos with us in Israel, in Jerusalem. We went into a shul together, and we walked into the shul Friday night, and a fellow runs over to Rabbi Grossman, who's a very famous figure in Israel. He got the Israel Prize last year. He runs over and he hugs him, and he starts crying, and he says, Toda, 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 thank you, thank you, thank you. So this guy afterwards sits down next to me, and I said to him, how do you know Rabbi Grossman? He said, Rabbi Grossman saved my life. And I said, tell me the story. So he says, he was a soldier in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. As you know, the Mount Hermon was captured by the Syrians. It's the highest mountain in Israel, tremendous strategic importance. Soldiers in his unit were supposed to retake it. He said they were profoundly demoralized. Everyone was totally pessimistic. They did not believe they'd make it. They believed they'd die trying. And even if they succeeded, they'd have forced to give it up. So there was a total lack of morale. Everyone was very upset and depressed. And the officers decided to bring in Rabbi Grossman to speak to the troops before they went into battle, to boost morale. Of course, another officer decided to boost morale. He brought in a rock group by the name of Chocolat Menta Mastic, which means chocolate peppermint bubblegum. It was a famous rock group in Israel in the 70s. So Rabbi Grossman and Chocolat Menta Mastic walk in at the same time. So Chocolat says to Rabbi Grossman, says, look, we can't be, you know. Rabbi Grossman says, no, we'll perform together. Get up on stage with me. Rabbi Grossman tells the soldiers the following. He says, it says in the Torah that when the priest speaks to the Jewish army in biblical times, he started off by saying, Shema Israel, hear O Israel. Atem krevim hayom l'milchama alozechem, you are approaching battle with your enemies, as we are today in Israel. Don't be afraid. Don't panic. Don't be crushed. Don't be broken. Because God who fought for you and took you out of Egypt, he is with you. Very beautiful verse. And Rashi, in a commentary on that verse, says, why does he start with the word Shema Israel? Rashi says, Shema Israel means Hear, O Israel. He's talking to the Jewish army. Of course, Shema Israel. Why does he have to start with those words? Rashi says he is hinting to the soldiers that if they just have the merit of Shema Israel, Hear, O Israel, belief in God, belief that God, he is, that we have a special relationship, that we are his people, and that we are here to bring one God and that message to the world, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, just that merit is enough to guarantee victory over our enemies. So he said to the soldiers, that's what Rashi tells us. He says, would you like to listen to rock songs now, or can we say Shema Yisrael together before we go into battle? And about 1,000 soldiers all yelled Shema Yisrael together with him. And he got the band to play the Karlbach tune to Shema Yisrael. And they sung Shema Yisrael together for a good 20 minutes. And he said, this soldier told me, he says, when we finished that, we were different people. We were confident. We were optimistic. We were full of faith in ourselves, faith in God. We knew we'd win. And he said, that saved my life. That's Shema Yisrael. I was in California a year after that, and I told that story in Beverly Hills, and a large Israeli came over to me after davening, hugged me, and started crying. I said, you also know Rabbi Grossman? And he said, I was there. You did not exaggerate one iota. Saved my life as well. So we have that merit. We are studying Torah together, and we have that belief in God and belief in ourselves and belief in the Jewish people. Let that merit help ensure victory for our soldiers who are fighting now against our enemies, for the return of those who were captured back to the Jewish people, and for the refuah shleimah, healing of all those who were injured, all those who were wounded. Thank you very much for coming. We'll see you around. Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I read about that, yeah. Right. Thank you. Thanks for having us. Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for coming. Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for coming.
No, I didn't. I did bring my book, though. Oh, okay. I can bring it. Yeah, sure.